time for our next case, which is case number 74901, Luis Alejandro Mendez-Cordero versus the State of Nevada. We have Mr. Petty here representing the appellant, Ms. Kate representing the respondent. First of all, before we start, just make a comment to both of you. I know both of you do a lot of extra work other than your duties with the with your respective offices. Mr. Petty, you've been on innumerable committees for the Supreme Court. We appreciate all of that. Your Board of Bar Examiners, and I had a chance to work with Ms. Kate on the Commission for Judicial Selection for the Washoe County Family Court seat. It was a pleasure to work with her and her contributions as well. So thank you for that, and we appreciate all those efforts in addition to your services here to the bar as well. With that background, Mr. Petty, you can come on up here, and if you great, maybe you can come down to Clark County and help them out down there. Okay, with that background, Mr. Petty, would you like to reserve any time in rebuttal?
I'd like to reserve 4 minutes.
Oh, you may do so.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. My name is John Petty, and I'm here this afternoon on behalf of Mr. Luis Mendez-Cordero. This case presents an interesting issue of first impression, but it is not an issue of first impression that's in a vacuum. I'll share with you a sentence. Quote, in Nevada, completed jury questionnaires are open to the public and the press, unquote. That's from Justice Pickering's dissent in an opinion that was issued last year, State v. Second Judicial District Court, OHEA. Justice Pickering cited to an earlier case of this court, which is Stevens Media, a case that was decided 10 years ago. And in that particular case, this court held, quote, that jury questionnaires used in jury selection are, like the jury selection process itself, presumptively subject to public disclosure. The presumption of openness may be overcome, however, only if the district court identifies a countervailing interest to public access and demonstrates by specific findings that closure is necessary and narrowly tailored to serve a higher interest, unquote.
Isn't that just exactly what happened here?
That is not exactly what happened, but I will say this before we get to what actually happened. The issue that's presented in this case deals with the formation of an anonymous jury. The idea of an anonymous jury is not a sort of singular idea. There are a variety of variations that can come into play. And one of the concerns that we express here is that when Judge Flanagan, when the district court made the determination to impanel an anonymous jury, he went almost to the nuclear option as opposed to thinking about or constructing, maybe tailoring, if you will, lesser considerations to achieve the same end.
Well, and my understanding was he still got the questionnaires, but there were numbers on, there were no names available to you.
Well, no. I was looking at the jury selection and comments that are made between the court and counsel about the information they do have. What my understanding is, on the redacted sheets that were given to counsel, right, as opposed to there was a limited 22 questionnaires that were looked at independently that actually had the information on it. The ones that were redacted, what they had was they had a juror number, gender, zip code, whether the juror was employed but not in what capacity. That's what it had. It also didn't have spousal names or spousal employment. It didn't have a lot of the information that we normally see on a jury questionnaire. So there was some information on the questionnaire. It wasn't completely, here's your number and that's all you have. But there wasn't a lot of specific information with regards to that individual potential juror. I think there are a couple of areas that Ms. Kate and I agree on. We believe that the standard of review for the court is abuse of discretion. We believe that whether or not to impanel an anonymous jury should be considered by the district court, that it should be considered only in exceptional circumstances. In the language of some cases, They've said that the impaneling anonymous jury should be done in those situations, in rare situations, because it is a drastic, it is a last resort kind of option. And the reason for that is that the formation of an anonymous jury implicates at least two, perhaps more, but at least two fundamental rights of a defendant, the right to a presumption of innocence, because if a jury thinks, if jurors think that by virtue of the fact that they're being identified by numbers as opposed by name and such, they will conflate that with the idea that the defendant must be, for some reason, dangerous, or there's some dangerous aspect about this case.
But can't that be mitigated as it was here? I thought the judge went to great lengths to do that. In fact, came up with the explanation to the jurors that it was because of the media exposure, and she didn't want them pestered by the media.
I know that, and this was this case is kind of the posture of this case is kind of odd, because it is Judge Flanagan who made all the preliminary rulings on anonymous jury, and Judge Steinhammer, who inherited this case to trial, followed through on that. So when I speak about the anonymous jury, I'm talking about Judge Flanagan's rulings. He did say that what he was going to do is tell the jury that we're using numbers so that you're not subject to media harassment. He did, in fact, say that. Our contention is, and if this court finds that that was an effort, and if this court finds that it was a sufficient effort, our contention is that there were other things that could have been done. That piece was probably an appropriate attempt to mollify the danger. Whether it had a complete effect, we don't know, because it's hard to tell from this record if anybody was upset by the fact that the numbers were being used. Our contention is that in this particular case, if you are going to impanel an anonymous jury, you have to do so. There has to be something in the record that shows that it is important to do it. There is a standard that you find in the federal courts that talk about a specific important reason for doing so. And our contention is that if you look at the record in this case, Judge Flanagan, at a pretrial hearing sometime in September, towards the end of a pretrial hearing, announced his belief, what he characterized it as, I'm contemplating imposing or impaneling an anonymous jury. But it was clear that it was more than just contemplation, because he had already been in contact with our jury commissioner and had already, got steps underway to make it an anonymous jury. So it wasn't as if anybody had asked him. In fact, no party asked him for that. The state didn't, and defense obviously didn't. They objected. Later, when it became time for the jury to be questioned and selected, the jury questionnaires had been provided to counsel, and as I said, with very, very limited information, and the jurors were given numbers. The judge, at a pretrial hearing that morning, asked the state to call a witness to place on the record the reasons in support of an anonymous jury. And if you look at that record, you can look, it's in volume 2, and it starts at page 295 and carries over to page 296. So it's two pages. And in those two pages, the officer, Agent Freestone, acknowledges under questioning that MS-13 is a gang, a racketeering gang. MS-13, that Mr. Cordero is a member of MS-13, and that Mr. Cordero is sports a number of tattoos that relate to that membership. And if you look at the three specific reasons that the Judge Flanagan gave for the necessity of impaneling, he said, they're a gang, he belongs to the gang, and if he's convicted, he's going to suffer a lengthy sentence. He also said that this membership somehow, that there was the capacity that the jury could be in danger or affected. But there is absolutely nothing in the record.
But Mr. Petty, weren't there threats against witnesses? Wasn't the defendant trying to intimidate witnesses? And didn't the court have that information before it made its final determination on anonymity?
It did. And what it did in one instance, for example, there was some indication that some discovery was getting to third parties, and it was obviously coming from Mr. Cordero. And on motion of the state, the court ordered that stop, and it did. Later, there was some suggestion that I'm trying to think of what it was, but in any event, the issue was brought to the attention of the court. The court entered an order, and it was complied with. What we think here, with regards to the anonymous jury, for example, is the court didn't have to go to a full-scale anonymity. It could have said, okay, counsel, I'm going to give you the jury questionnaire so that you can properly use them in voir dire, so you can make informed for-cause challenges, and you can exercise your peremptory challenges intelligently, but you cannot share those questionnaires with your client. The court could have done that. It did not.
But some opportunity for counsel to see some of the unredacted questionnaires. What's the sequence of events on that?
Okay, so in that instance, the jury was scheduled to come in the afternoon because they called a large number of people. They wanted them to come in at 1:30. Mm-hmm. So in that morning, they were doing some housekeeping matters, and the judge indicated that he has approximately 22 questionnaires, and he had them by number, and they're reflected in the record. And he said to counsel, I've gone through these, and these look like a bunch that we might just want to get rid of right out of the chute, because it looks to me like they have law enforcement connections and some other things. And counsel asked if when could they see them, and they're going to look at them over the lunch hour. Counsel asked if instead of doing that, perhaps we could look at all of the questionnaires over that afternoon and bring the jury in tomorrow morning, so that at least we have an idea of what we're dealing with. The court declined that. So those 22 questionnaires,
okay,
they aren't part of the, I mean, ultimately they became part of the panel, but those specific questionnaires, the counsel were allowed to look at it over the lunch hour for about 45 minutes, maybe an hour.
Can I ask you, I have a question. What can you point to as far as prejudice? Besides the name and address, how were you prejudiced in jury selection? I mean, what can you point to?
You know, Justice Silver, that is always the worst question to ask in some of these cases, because I don't have a good answer for you. I'm not going to concede harmless error, but as I stand here today, it's hard for me to look at the record that I have.
I mean, you did have zip codes, too, so you knew generally the area somebody resided in.
Yes, we had zip codes. We had the fact that the person was employed, but not in what capacity. Before I surrender all of my time, I just want to make one comment. If the court is not inclined to give relief on the anonymous jury, the court should look at the sentencing issue. I think the jury was improperly kept ignorant of information with regards to the possibility of weapon enhancements that they could have used in assessing what would be the appropriate penalty for the primary offenses. And it could have been the case that they might have returned a life with the possibility as opposed to a life without. We don't know. With that, I'll save the balance of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Petty. Yeah.
Thank you.
Ms. Kate?
Thank you, Chief Justice Gibbons. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Marilee Kate. I represent the state of Nevada in this case. This court should affirm Luis Mendez Cordero's conviction because he received a fair trial. The district court did not abuse its discretion with respect to any grounds raised in the appeal, and the evidence of his guilt was overwhelming, so that if this court concludes that there was an error, that error would be harmless. With respect to the anonymous jury, I'll jump right in. I think Mr. Petty is arguing that the court went to this nuclear option with respect to the anonymous jury. And I think an important case with respect to that is U.S. v. Edgen. That's the District of Columbia Circuit Court case from 1995. The citation for that is 52 F3rd 1080. In that case, a similar argument was made that, you know, the court could have just sequestered the jurors and that would avoid this potential of harm or this, you know, this concern. And there, the Edmund court said, well, no, that doesn't take into account what could happen after with this information. If the jury information is provided, not during trial, but later, there still could be danger to those jurors down the road. And Justice Perry asked the question about, well, weren't there threats? And Justice Siglitz talked about the threats in this case. There were threats in this case. The record actually in this case indicates that Mendez-Cordero was sharing discovery related to the witnesses in the case well before trial. In fact, in the first motion provided by the state or done by the state to limit the dissemination of discovery, the state brought to the court's attention the fact that Mendez-Cordero actually had identified one of the confidential informants in this case through discovery that he was provided. And not only did he identify the confidential informant, but he was providing it to other members of MS-13, known members of MS-13. And so then you have that. Then you have the threats made in the iWeb and the telephone call, where that was August 2017, so about a month before trial. Mendez-Cordero is saying that he's asking known associates of MS-13 to buy a phone or a brain, that Elder Rodriguez Primo, that's the individual who took Mendez-Cordero to the party that night, that Primo, he could change the outcome of the case. And so he wanted his associates to send a message to Primo that if he showed up, his wife could be killed. And then you have the next day, Mendez-Cordero following up on that and saying, send him the message. And what's interesting, and, you know, Mr. Petty argues, well, Mendez-Cordero complied with the court's order not to disseminate discovery anymore after that initial order that the district court entered. I believe that order was entered on September 11th. He didn't. What comes up at the end in September, I think the hearing was September 29th, so right before trial, the week before trial, the district court considered an emergency motion by the state to limit Mendez-Cordero's communications to only his defense counsel. And the reason that or the record reveals that on September 24th and 26th, Mendez-Cordero is again contacting known members of MS-13, talking about witnesses in this case.
That's not really uncommon in gang cases. It's very common for defendants in gang cases to threaten witness or have other people threaten witness. It's not uncommon. What connection can you make that somehow there needed to be protection for these jurors? Where is that?
And so,
where's the nexus?
So if you look at the federal case law, there's a discussion about the general willingness to obstruct justice. And in the first prong of the federal test, it talks about juror protection or just ensuring that the jury members can perform their fact-finding function. In this case, even though he started with witnesses, at that point he doesn't have access to juror information, but he has demonstrated his willingness to obstruct justice in this case. And so that prong, I guess I would say, would be met. And the district court made that finding. I think that's another piece. You know, that's where Mr. Petty and I disagree about the record made. Certainly in this case, you know, the district court made its record at the September 29th hearing and said, I'm concerned about the witnesses in this case, the juries in this case. I'm concerned about the integrity of the process. And that's really one of the things that the district court in handling the anonymous jury did. It ensured that this process would be integrity. There would be integrity here. And what the district court did in looking at that is then on the following Monday, made findings with respect to each prong of kind of that first, or I guess each factor in that first prong of the federal test. And so the district court said, you know, made the finding that Mendez-Cordero is involved with organized crime, MS-13. He received testimony on that. And even though Agent Freestone or the state put Agent Freestone on that morning, that doesn't necessarily mean that that was an inappropriate time to do it, because under federal law and what the law that the state submits that you should adopt here is anything in the record can support the district court's decision to impanel a anonymous jury. So, you know, at trial, information came out from Christine Yost, whose house the murders occurred at. She said she knew that Mendez Cordero was a member of MS-13. You know, it wasn't just Agent Freestone that testified through trial. That information came out through trial.
Ms. Kate, may I inquire, was there particular biographical data that the court ordered excluded that inhibited the defendant's or the state's ability to properly voir dire jurors?
Thank you for the question, Justice Stiglitz. That was one of the things I noted about Mr. Petty's argument. We disagree about what actually was provided to the jury, I think, or to counsel, excuse me. And the state actually in this appeal, moved to transmit both copies, the redacted and unredacted version of the jurors' questionnaires. And to the extent this court thinks that, you know, looking at that would be helpful, the state would remove to do that for this court's consideration, because based on the state's reading of the record, it appears that there was employment information, generally, your occupation was provided to counsel. The spouse's occupation was provided to counsel. Justice Silver asked about zip codes, I think, to Mr. Petty. That was provided, at least based on what I could glean for the record. There was also information provided about whether the individuals had members of family and law enforcement. At least from my reading of the record and what even defense counsel was asking the jurors, they went right to the question about law enforcement bias or having prior experience with a jury trial or anything like that. And so, you know, to the extent that the court thinks that would be dispositive to this issue, I'd remove to transmit those things to this court so you can actually review what was redacted. But the state submits there was a significant amount of information provided.
Could a jurisdiction adopt across the board, we're not going to give names of jurors. Jurors will always be assigned a number. That's how they'll be referred. Could they adopt such a system in a jurisdiction-wide that would pass constitutional muster?
You know, Justice Stiglitz, I don't think so. I think I agree that this is an unusual measure, but this is that case.
But how does having a name hinder or promote your ability to figure out a for-cause challenge or to question a witness?
Well, in today's age, with technology, I think you can find out a lot of information about a jury member by just simply Googling them, looking on Facebook, doing things like that. You can, and not to mention, if, you know, the state chooses, pursuant to Ojeda, to run criminal history and provide that information. So a name can certainly provide a lot of information, but I also, the point's well taken that for some people, they have no impact in the technology world, right? They're not on Facebook, they're not on social media in any respect, and so maybe that information isn't helpful. But your name could, you know, you can search the Washoe County Recorder record to find somebody's house if you have their name.
Why not, though, give counsel? I mean, if the danger is the defendant finding out this information, what's wrong with at least giving, you know, making an anonymous jury, but giving counsel, so defense counsel has their name and address. The state has their name and address, but there's an order that is not to be given to the defendant, and at least then perhaps the defense has that to look at. Why not just give it to counsel?
Thank you, Justice Silver. So I think in the courtroom, when counsel is doing jury selection, their client is right there. So they're going to have access and will at least be able to view these names on the table with counsel. I mean, when you're doing jury selection, I don't know how it's traditionally done in Las Vegas, but sometimes up in the North, we're using Post-its and we are flipping through each.
I'm not talking about the selection. I'm talking about at least giving them an opportunity to look at that. Why not? I'm not saying you have to give it to them so that they can sit there with the defendant and look at it, but why not? Maybe the weekend before, at least give them that. There may be names that they recognize or tied to certain families or they know certain things about whatever.
Well, certainly.
And then not give it to the defendant. Maybe it's not in the courtroom.
And certainly, I think that's an alternative, but at the same time, that's not really what the federal test requires if this court adopts that. You know, the second prong of the test is reasonable safeguards are adopted to avoid infringement to the defendant's fundamental rights. And in this case, the district court did the instruction that the jury shouldn't be concerned about the reason that they're being identified by number because it was protecting them from media harassment. But also the district court went further and allowed thorough voir dire, still did provide significant amount of information to counsel. And so if we're, you know, I think actually in the, I believe it was the People v. Goodwin case that was cited by Mendez-Cordero, talked about that was the alternative. Why don't we just tell counsel and we identify the individuals by number in the courtroom? In that case, the court actually recognized that's not an anonymous jury. And so, you know, if this court's looking at developing law related to the anonymous jury, the state submits that it should look at the federal test, apply the federal test, which doesn't require that the district court use the least restrictive means or completely minimize, but that it gives the district court that discretion to protect the integrity of the process. And that's what the district court did in this case.
Ms. Kate,
you have to harmonize it with Stevens Media in our jurisdiction, do you not?
Well, and so what's interesting, thank you for the question. Yes, I think in some fashion you do, but in that case what's interesting is the way that was raised is a First Amendment challenge by the press, and that second prong of the test talking about, you know, minimizing or considering those alternative methods was really because the defendant in that case didn't want the jury questionnaires disclosed. And so it was saying, you know, you have to consider these methods of protecting the defendant's right to fair trial, meaning he didn't want them disclosed because he was concerned about what the media attention would do on his right to a fair trial. Well, here, the second prong of the federal test addresses a defendant's right to a fair trial. And certainly, you know, many of the courts look to what actually happened at trial, whether, you know, was the voir dire complete? Was it searching and thorough? In the Manasori case, U.S. v. Manasori, that was cited by Mendez-Cordero, that was a Seventh Circuit case. There was no findings in the record by the district court. There was no instruction that why the jury was being identified anonymously. And in fact, the court there found they probably shouldn't have been identified anonymously, but ultimately concluded that, you know, the evidence in the record was overwhelming, the voir dire was searching and thorough, and that it wasn't a basis to overturn the case. And in fact, in any of the cases that either party has cited, none of them support overturning a case based on an anonymous jury. None of them actually did overturn a case based on the anonymous jury. So the state submits that in this case, you should adopt the federal test, that this case meets it, the factors met it, and that to the extent you're concerned that it doesn't meet it, that at least kind of look at that Manasori case, there was overwhelming evidence of guilt, and the voir dire is searching and thorough. The defendant Mendez-Cordero hasn't come forward and identified how he was actually prejudiced by this process. He said, well, you know, we may have been able to do more. This may have impacted our right to a fair trial, but really, you know, the record reveals that voir dire flushed out juror biases.
Ms. Kate, your time is running, and I have a question on a separate issue, the final issue raised by Mr. Petty. I have long been concerned about the rejection of a jury instruction that informs the jury in the sentencing phase of a first-degree murder trial of the existence, at least, of a weapon enhancement separate sentence. Maybe this instruction is crafted, went too far, but certainly it's something that was rejected primarily because the judge decided that that was within the province of the judge and the jury should not know that. My question is, why not? In the sentencing phase of a first-degree murder case, that's their responsibility. Why shouldn't they have that information?
Thank you, Justice Givens. Okay, thank you. So, Justice Hardesty, I appreciate that question. Thank you. You know, the state in this case suggested to the court, let's tell the jury the original instruction just provided the penalties for murder. And after it was raised by Mendez Cordero, said, let's tell the jury at least that there is a separate, you know, the district court will be sentencing on that. And so they did address that. But certainly what's one of the concerns that I have about providing specific information about sentencing that isn't in the province of the jury is the extension of that. Are we going to be suggesting that that should happen in every case and on every case that the jury doesn't consider sentencing? So in a burglary case, are we going to say, you know, include an instruction about what that sentence would be at the end? That's inconsistent with our...
The jury doesn't sentence in a burglary case. The jury does sentence in a first-degree murder case.
Right, but the issue or the sentence that we're talking about informing them about is something that is up to the judge, not the jury. And
well,
so,
but it's a mandatory enhancement. It's a mandatory extension. The jury doesn't even know this guy is going to get additional time no matter what they do.
And I would disagree because the instruction did provide that that would be that sentencing enhancement would be done by the court later. And so they were informed that there would at least be something additional provided by the court. So to the extent that's the concern, I think the instruction, I believe it was instruction 5, yes, instruction 5 provides that the sentence for the deadly weapon enhancement will be determined by the court at a later date. And so the district court did properly
instruct. And I just say, it is going to be a consecutive 1 to 20. I mean, that's a fact. It's not like another crime where, a judge could give a concurrent sentence. If it's a robbery, maybe do a concurrence and throw it away. This is an actual consecutive sentence of 1 to 20.
And I think...
Why not?
So I think if this court does find that that's appropriate, the instruction that was offered doesn't explain that and doesn't explain what consecutive means. It doesn't explain that the judge could potentially sentence consecutive for both murder counts. It doesn't explain so many pieces. It also deals with kind of this truth in sentencing, work time credits, good time credits. Quite honestly, as a practitioner, I have a hard time telling somebody how long an individual is going to be in prison if it is a sentence for a DUI, for example, because they could get work time credits, they could get credits for earning a GED. So that's something that turns this analysis into a math equation and not something based on the facts. And the facts in this case indicate that the jury sentenced Mendez Cordero to life without the possibility of parole. They were told what that means. They were told that that meant that he would never get out. And that's what they sentenced him to. So the fact that there was not this information wouldn't have made a difference in this case. And with that, thank you very much. I would conclude just by saying that this court should affirm the judgment of conviction. Again, Mendez Cordero received a fair trial. There was not an abuse of discretion in this case, and evidence of guilt was overwhelming to the extent that this court finds that there was error. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kate. Mr. Petty, we'll add 2 minutes to your time since we ran over with Ms. Cates.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I will be brief. I just want to touch on the sentencing issue first. The jury should have been told about the effect of their consecutive sentences. What they were told by the court was, and this is the sentence that follows, this is how they were instructed on the issue of the enhancement. Quote, the sentence for the deadly weapon enhancement will be determined by the court at a later date, period, unquote, or end quotes. What that doesn't tell them is it doesn't tell them the consecutive nature, the mandatory consecutive nature of that sentence, and it doesn't tell them the range of that possible sentence. And our argument is the defense wasn't asking for the jury to impose a sentence, an enhanced sentence, or even make a recommendation. We just wanted the jury to be aware of the fact that this was an additional penalty, and please factor that into your assessment as to what you think the appropriate penalty for the primary offense should be. Jury should be.
Is there authority from other states for doing that?
This case that I cited is the United States Supreme Court case that was written by Chief Justice John Roberts, and it's Dean versus United States. It's a unanimous case. That case dealt with federal sentencing by a federal judge, but the principle obtains, and that is, Justice Roberts said, a sentencing judge shouldn't ignore that effect, and our argument is that a jury shouldn't be kept in the dark about that effect. With regards to the anonymous jury, a couple of things. In the Fourth Circuit case, Dinkins v. United States, that I cited to the court in my briefs, there is a sentence, and it says, a district court's decision to impanel an anonymous jury must rest on something more than speculation or inference of possible harm. There is absolutely nothing in this record showing that the jury could potentially suffer some harm. The record shows that Judge Flanagan makes a note that the case itself has received very little publicity leading up to the time of trial, that the only real publicity was the day of trial, and for those of us who live in Northern Nevada and who get the Reno Gazette Journal, I think I can say this comfortably. Every time there is an important murder case in the Second Judicial District Court, it is going to be on page one of the Reno Gazette Journal the morning of the trial. So the fact that that happened in this case is consistent with the practice of the Reno Gazette Journal, at least in my experience. You can look at this record and when you make a determination, did the court abuse its discretion? Ms. Cates, right, the federal authorities say, look at the record, this is a non-capital case, so look at the record. You're not just stuck with what the court knew at the time. You can go through the entire trial process, and there is not one iota, one shred of evidence that the jury was ever at any risk during the course of this trial. We think that evidence, coupled with the fact that it was a sui sponte decision, not asked by the parties. There's a case that Barry Bonds had, the former player for the Giants, where his counsel and the state and the government jointly requested an anonymous jury because they didn't want anybody influencing the jury that was going to try that case. That's not this case. This case, the defendant subjected. We think it was inappropriate. We think Judge Flanagan abused his discretion, and we'll leave it at that.
Mr. Petty, can you point to an instance where counsel was inhibited from their voir dire by virtue of these redactions?
Thank you, Justice. I was, actually, when you asked that question of Ms. Cade, I was thinking about that. And the best I could come up with is, there are known unknowns and there are unknown unknowns. We know in this case, for example, that there was information we used to get, or we would normally get, but we didn't get this time. So we know that unknown. But we don't know the information that we might have had if we had had all that information. So consider this. Let's say you go in, you're going to try a case in the Second Judicial District Court, and the Second Judicial District Court has decided, we're just not going to give you jury questionnaires, period. You can conduct your voir dire of each of the panel members based on whatever answers they give me, the judge, in my initial questioning. May I complete my thought?
Go ahead and proceed.
I'll be very quick. And then you can just have a go at it. But one of the things that Stevens Media says is that the voir dire process and jury questionnaires make that process exceptionally efficient and fair, because when you come into court, you have at least some bedrock information about the members of that potential jury pool. This case didn't give counsel sufficient bedrock information, and so we would ask you to consider that.
Ask a question.
Yes.
Chief. In some jurisdictions, you don't get the jury information, including questionnaires, until you walk through the door to pick the jury. Are those constitutionally infirm?
I am not prepared today to say that they are or not. If the practice is taking place and it hasn't been challenged, or if it hasn't, it's been affirmed, then they're not. But in the Second Judicial District Court, that's not our process. That's not our practice. In the Second Judicial District Court, we have access to those jury questionnaires, and we have access to shared information with the state if they elect to run information on that.
Thank you, Mr. Excellent arguments and briefs. We will take this case under submission, and we'll be in recess till the next call of the court.